And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Is it a dream or a nightmare? Imagine, if you will, living with a pack of wolves, becoming a member of the pack, living with wolves in the wilds of Idaho for 6 years. A dream? A nightmare? We find out when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News, and now, Sydney Wildsmith.
As the first snows begin turning this year of weather into the next expression of climate change, who knows what may lie ahead. The wild creatures get ready to deal with it, as they have for thousands and millions of years. Imagine you're a field mouse in Illinois, and the first snow has fallen. The light first snow is taller than you. How do you know what to do? And if you've been through this before, are there memories of the winter, running the under-snow pathways you've cut as your new domain? Or what if you're a bison on Yellowstone, where the winter has already made its first stand? Does the brisk winds, laden with icy crystals that cling and cake to your face, how does it make you feel? How does it change the way you look into the dark eyes of your clan? Or a wolf in the sawtooth ranges of Idaho, your first winter as a yearling pup. What does this mean to you? How might this affect you and your pack? Today, we take a look at animals and their perceptions. That wolf pack in Idaho, it's for real. And today's guests, Jim and Jamie Dutcher, spent 6 years living with the sawtooth pack. These Emmy Award-winning filmmakers will share their perceptions, which they've captured in a wonderful new book, Living with Wolves, published by Mountaineers Books. So following the news, we go in-depth into the realms of being wolf and the mysteries of the pack. So first, the news. The push to get oil rigs drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is front and center again as the Senate debates its budget legislation. Drilling in Anwar has been bolted into this budget legislation, which, under Senate rules, cannot be filibustered, under the rubric that it will collect $2.4 billion in fees from leasing tracts to big oil companies. U.S. Interior Secretary Gail Norton has admitted that it will take 7 to 10 years for significant volumes of oil to flow from Anwar once Congress gives the okay for exploration. When in full production, the Anwar fields would be expected to produce the equivalent of the oil disrupted due to the Katrina and Rita hurricanes. If adopted, the House would have to ratify a similar budget bill. The legislation is written limiting the total land surface occupied by oil equipment and machinery to 2,000 acres. However, those 2,000 acres can be in the form of hundreds of miles of pipelines and scattered pads. Some argue that such justifications are like saying that a scratch across the Mona Lisa would only affect a very small area of surface and should be considered only a minor impact. In nature, there is often more than meets the eye. That certainly is the case with male mice. Seems the little fellows are quite adept songsters. We just hadn't heard them before. Timothy E. Holy, a neurobiologist at the Washington University and St. Louis School of Medicine, recorded and augmented the ultrasonic vocalizations of male mice to find that they have a richness and diversity of mouse song that appears to approach that of many songbirds. Like the avian counterparts, mice seem to sing for, well, sex. The songs are courtship ballads, complex in their variety, and a bit more free-form than birds, whose songs reflect species specification. The next step in the research is to play the ultrasonics to females to see if any collateral courtship behaviors are exhibited. The real question seems to be, what are you waiting for? Play the songs. We want to see what happens. The famous wild parrots of Telegraph Hill, which became a minor cult phenomenon due to the documentary film of the same name, have run for the hills as one of their three homing trees was cut down for safety reasons. Mark Bittner, the soft-spoken homeless bird lover who became the star of the film and who now travels the world telling of the effect the birds had on reshaping his life, has been negotiating with the owners of the trees and the shed that had been his home. Approximately 200 green conyers, native to South America, have become permanent residents of San Francisco and use the three cypress trees as their home. When the first of the three trees fell, the birds took off and have not returned to their roost. It's the talk of the town in San Francisco, but as yet, the birds have not given their statement. And that's the news. And now, let's find out what living with wolves is all about. Having grown up in Minnesota, I was very fortunate, and when I started my career as a naturalist, to be able to say, hey, I live in the state where we have wolves. And there was a very active program of researching wolves and protecting wolves, and one of the first. And from that grew a lot of the research and the efforts to maintain and protect wolves in the continental United States, which is actually succeeding to some degree. Joining us now on the Wild Side News are two people who've had a most amazing experience with wolves. They have a new book out called Living with Wolves, and this is Jim and Jamie Dutcher. I want to welcome you to the Wild Side News.
Thank you, Sydney.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
First of all, let's talk about your new book. It's Living with Wolves, produced by great friends of mine at Mountaineers Books. This is going to be part of a companion to the video, because you both are, Jim, you're a videographer, and Jamie, you really focus on sound, but you are a team. But tell us the nature of the book, Living with Wolves, and its relationship to the video.
Well, it's based on our experiences with the wolves, but also a background of what wolves are all about. In the back of the book, there's a CD of vocalizations that Jamie put together.
It really is a bit of extension from the film, in that it gives people more of an insight of what these wolves are really all about and how they are connected to the natural world. And you may or may not know, Mountaineers is a nonprofit publisher, and we've done this with them in conjunction with the Wilderness Society to sort of make people a little bit more aware of how important it is to save the environment. We've got to remember to save our open spaces and leave corridors open in order for animals like wolves to be able to return to their natural place.
There is a film that's associated with the book. How can people find out more about the film?
Well, the film was produced for the Discovery Channel as an anniversary special. It's 95 minutes long. And it came out in May, and it's available through their website. But the film is basically the whole history of the sawtooth pack, a pack of wolves that we raised from puppies, and what happened to them. And it's the story of their family.
Well, let's talk about this sawtooth. Now, first of all, you're located in Ketchum, Idaho, which is another grand extension of God's country, and specifically, you started this project in an area around Stanley, Idaho.
That's right.
I've been to Stanley. There's an ancient picture of me sitting there beside some sort of falling over structure, some sort of old miner's shack. Is that still there?
Yeah, the shack is probably there. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. It's a very small place, about 50, 60 people, something like that. Sorry, maybe 100 in the summer.
Yes. Well, it is really a perfect expression of the wild and open spaces, and Idaho has that. And the Sawtooth Range itself is an extraordinary area. Let's talk about the Sawtooth Range a little bit so people have a sense of what that area is like.
The Sawtooths are a range of mountains, sort of similar to the Tetons in central Idaho. And what we did is we set up a camp up in the mountains there, right on the edge of wilderness. And our approach in making this film was to get close to the wolf, to get into the inner lives of wolves. And wolves are extremely afraid of people. And to see a wolf in the wild is difficult. And to capture their social behavior on film is almost impossible. So we started this project with pups, bottle feeding these puppies from the moment they were opening their eyes. And then we built this enclosure, which we later camped within, and released the pups in there. And over the years, introduced new pups. Wolves love pups, and they bonded to the new litter year after year. And eventually, at the end of the project, we had a litter born to our pack, which we called the Sawtooth Pack. And it was probably the first litter of pups born in the Sawtooth in 50 or 60 years.
Yes. How big an enclosure did you create?
The enclosure was huge. It was 25 acres in size. It contained ponds and streams and aspen groves. It was really quite a wild setting, and we would have to travel on a snowmobile in the winter of 5 or 6 miles and all-terrain vehicle in the summertime just to bring in supplies.
Yeah, Stanley often records the coldest temperatures in the lower 48 in the winter, and we'd have temperatures that would hover around 40 below for days at a time. And it's important to note that, you know, when people hear, oh, you know, you did this in an enclosure, all studies on wolf behavior have been done in enclosures, but usually of 1 to 3 acres. So we had the largest wolf enclosure in the world, because wolves are so sensitive when there are people around. You can't really see this behavior in the wild. You have to do it in a captive setting.
Well, and of course, the reason for that is that through the many years, they've learned that humans primarily mean disaster for them.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Yes, people have eliminated the wolf. There were about 2 million of them that were killed. There was bounties set on them, and once the bounties were set, they killed off the wolves in about a decade or so. And mostly that's because wolves are so bonded to each other. They're a family. And there were horrible tactics that they used, like baiting fish hooks and putting them down dens and bringing out the pups, and the pack would come back to defend the pups, and they would be shot.
Thank God we've progressed way past that to a large extent so far. Let's keep that growing. That's obviously one of your missions, is to make sure that people really can appreciate the complex and extraordinary nature of the wolf and the wolf pack.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Sidney. What we're trying to do is talk about how social and caring this animal is. We were amazed at how, as a family animal, how they taught their young and cared for each other. They settled disputes. They mourned lost relatives. They were quite a family.
Well, let's start out with these. You started out with 6 small wolf pups. What was it like? You had a challenge, because you wanted to be able to have them become comfortable with you as humans, but without really affecting their behaviors and enculturating them into a human society. That had to be a challenge.
It was, and what we basically did is, you know, as Jim said before, we started off just before they were opening their eyes, and they were the first things that we saw, and we would bottle feed them, and we would really treat them as a mother wolf would do that. We would where the mother wolf would use her tongue to lick and soothe the pups, we would use warm towels and washcloths. We would nurse them. We would just be around them. We made a point to not assert ourselves on the wolves. They would, you know, they would play around us, and wolf pups can get incredibly aggressive. And, you know, we would just kind of gently, you know, put the pup down a little bit and growl at it as its mother would, and then, you know, they would go on. But we didn't want the wolves to grow up looking at us as dominant members and change their behavior. We wanted to be completely neutral. And it really seemed to work. The wolves were comfortable around us. We could have our equipment out. We could be filming them, and they wouldn't stop what they were doing. And we were just there. They would have their disputes with one another inches from our face. They would be growling at each other, and we could just be sitting there. And it had nothing to do with us. And you'll see pictures in the book, and then scenes in the film as well, where we're very close to the wolves. You know, we're touching the wolves. And it's important to know that, that all of that was on their terms. The wolves came to us if they chose to. We didn't go to them.
During that first year, as these young pups were growing up, and they were pups at that point, and they didn't really have an adult to do the kind of basic training. You kind of were that, but you weren't at the same time. How much time did you really spend with them? Were they in the enclosure running free, and then you would enter the enclosure and interact?
Well, with the pups, we would raise them right there in the camp, in the tent, bottle feeding them, staying up with them during the night. You know, we'd have different shifts and take turns. But we have to feed them about 3 to 5 times a day.
Mm-hmm.
As they grew older, we introduced them into the larger enclosure and later new litters after that. And so they had a lot of space to roam.
Now also, how would you help them to do wolf things, the hunting, the stalking, that type of thing?
Well, they seemed to have that instinct in them. They knew they would chase after mice and squirrels and rabbits. It seemed to be not learned behavior, but instinctive behavior.
Yeah, I think what they're finding, you know, with some reintroduced wolves, that, you know, wolves that that are not familiar, for instance, with bison, have a very hard time killing bison because they're not used to that kind of a prey. But the hunting instinct is there in the animals. So our wolves were able to hunt and stalk small game in the enclosure, rabbits, squirrels, foxes that would get in, some birds. But because it was an enclosure, we would have to bring them their larger meals. We would bring them roadkill, deer, elk, and antelope. And they would settle, you know, work out their hierarchies, and we would watch that amongst the carcass.
I'd just be curious. That, of course, is one of the most fascinating aspects of wolves, and that is this hierarchy in the pack. How soon were you able to begin to distinguish what appeared to be some sort of hierarchy in this the six initial wolves?
What we noticed right away with the puppies is that they had their own hierarchy within the puppy pack. And as years went on, that shifted a great deal. But for some reason, the little pup, Kamatz, which was turned out to be the alpha, always seemed to have a lot of confidence. And if I picked up that pup and moved him away, he would be very relaxed. Now, if I picked up another pup, she would be perhaps uncomfortable with being separated from her litter mates and want to get back on the ground and want to dominate them because she wasn't too sure of where her position was. But the alpha pup, he knew right away where he belonged.
When did you initiate them into the enclosures, trying to get a sense of timing here, and they would have to overwinter, and that's a tough winter up there.
Right. The pups are born in spring, and by winter, they need to be full-grown practically, so they can run with a pack and be able to keep up and go through the deep snow and feed. So they grow very aggressively, very fast, and it seems like the alphas, the adults, would almost force that on the pups so that they would mature in a rapid way. We started our project with not just these pups, but also two adults, and they were socialized to people, but not to ourselves, and they were all right, but they never seemed to be quite relaxed with us. And they would dominate the puppy pack. In the film, you can see one of them had cataracts, and that's a whole other story. And she sort of separated herself apart, and we went into an operation on her, actually sedating her, putting in her into the tent. Got a physician from Oregon, and he came out and performed cataract operation on this pup. But the adults would teach the pups quite a bit, and but they never seemed to, the adults never seemed to bond with us, so we decided that it was after the eye operation it was time to get rid of the two adults and stick with the sawtooth pack puppies, and that's what we did.
Yeah, but generally, you know, since we had the adult pups, pretty much as soon as the pups were done nursing and were on solid food, they would be introduced into the enclosure with the adult wolves. So that would be like late spring, early summer. And they would just, you know, continue to grow and eat with the adults. And then by wintertime, you know, they've got their big fluffy coats and they look beautiful. and they're pretty much set for winter.
Were you able to introduce larger game to give these wolves the opportunity to do what they are instinctively inclined to do, and that is to take down as a pack a larger game?
Well, Sydney, actually, we would have loved to have done that. But because these wolves were born in captivity, and they were never going to be set free because they had lost the one thing they needed to survive in the wild, which was the fear of humans, it really wouldn't have been the right thing to do to put a deer or an elk in an enclosed situation for the wolves to go after. So we made a decision early on that we would not do something like that, because we know that wolves hunt large game. We know they travel long distances for a living, and this film was primarily about their social behavior. They did go after small game in the enclosure that was in there all the time, like rabbits, squirrels, birds, but for the large part, the larger ungulates that they were fed on a regular basis, the deer, elk, and antelope, were roadkill, and we would bring those in, and they were fed on a rotating schedule, which is exactly what it would be like in the wild. Instead of like in a zoo situation where they're fed every day, they're fed every 5 to 7 days.
Let's talk about year two and what began to develop in the pack.
Well, this was a six-year project, and for the first 3 years we produced one film, and then the next 3 years we produced another. And it was interesting to see that it really took about 3 years to study the behavior and see the family life of this pack. At the beginning, what we had was the four pups and two adults, and about the middle of that, about year two, we took the two adults away, and we introduced another litter of three pups. Hmm. And so the sub-adults now are the alphas, and we had a new litter, and that was just wonderful for the pack. They love pups. You know, they would be so excited to lead them and bond with them, and they would also dominate them. They would make them roll over on their backs and submit, and just form a hierarchy. So and then on the third year we moved our camp, which was outside the enclosure, into the enclosure, and what we noticed is that the wolves were always so aware of what was going on in our camp when it was on the other side of the fence, that it was disruptive if we would go be with the wolves. So we moved our camp amongst them, and they stopped behaving. They started behaving more naturally because we were always there. And we started to seeing things that we had never seen before, because their focus now was on their family and not the human observers.
Just kind of give us a sense of, over the 6 years, what began to happen within that pack.
Well, over the 6 years, we really got a chance to see the hierarchy really develop. With each new litter of pups that we introduced to the pack, the dynamics of the hierarchy changed a little bit. The alpha, Kamath, was always the alpha, but there were shifts in the omega position. It was interesting that in the second year, we had a wolf introduced by the name of Motsi, who really took on the role as Beta, second in command, and he held that position all the way through. But it gave a chance through the project for the mid-ranking wolves to sort of shift in and out of their mid-ranking position, and it just made for a much richer social structure for us to watch, which, you know, just developed into to just a huge understanding of what these animals are all about.
Well, we're talking with Jim and Jamie Dutcher, who have a new book out called Living with Wolves. And when we come back, we're going to start getting to the daily routines of what it means to be a wolf and what it means to be a wolf in a wolf pack. We'll be right back.